Tonight on PBS News Weekend, Israel considers how to respond to Iran's attack as President Biden and other world leaders scramble to contain the confrontation. Then Amna Nawaz reports from Ukraine as Russia steps up pressure against Ukraine's dwindling defenses. And the drought ravaging southern Africa is threatening millions with hunger.
Our food situation is difficult. We only eat once a day because we have nothing in the fields, not a single grain. Everything has dried up in the drought.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. The day after Iran used drones and missiles to carry out its first ever direct assault on Israel, diplomacy took center stage today. Leaders from the White House to capitals around the globe are scrambling tonight to try to keep this unfolding and perilous conflict from spiraling out of control. Tonight, our coverage begins with Nick Schifrin.
Above the holiest sites in one of the world's holiest cities, rockets lit up the night sky, and Israeli air defense blocked an unprecedented Iranian attack across all of Israel. The Israeli Defense Forces said it thwarted 99% of more than 300 drones and missiles, the majority launched from Iran, but some also came from Iranian-backed proxies in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. American officials say the U.S. shot down at least 75 of them, almost all in Jordanian airspace. Israel said the only missiles that entered Israeli airspace were ballistic, including one that wounded a 7-year-old girl. Israel reported no deaths and only minor damage to an Air Force base. Iran said they were responding to Israel's killing senior Iranian generals inside Iran's Damascus consulate and called the attack tit for tat.
From our point of view, this operation is over and there is no intention to continue the operation. But if the Zionist regime takes any action against the Islamic Republic, our next operation will be much larger.
By the light of day, Israelis return to normal, but the region is anything but. And Israel's leadership says the incident is very much not over.
We are still on high alert and assessing the situation. Over the last few hours, we approved operational plans for both offensive and defensive action.
But the U.S. is counseling restraint. President Biden and the leaders of the world's seven largest industrialized nations warned Iran's attack could lead to, quote, uncontrollable escalation. They vowed to de-escalate. And in a phone call, Biden told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the U.S. would not take part in an Israeli retaliation. National Security spokesman John Kirby repeated that message this morning.
It's going to be up to the Israelis to decide what the next step is here. I will just say this. President Biden, since the beginning of this conflict, has worked very hard to keep this from becoming a broader regional war, to keep the tensions from escalating.
Senior administration officials said today the G7 group of countries could impose new coordinated sanctions, and other countries could join the U.S. in labeling the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist group. That is the diplomatic focus, John, that the U.S. wants, of course, but the major focus we are waiting for, the major response we're waiting for, is Israel's military response.
Nick, let's start by looking back at last night with this really remarkable effect of Israel blunting this attack. The United States did move some U.S. assets into the region. How important were they in this operation?
President Biden himself said it was absolutely essential. Over the last 10 days, Israel and the United States have been working, coordinated on this response, a senior administration official said, and that included moving fighter squadrons into better positions, and those fighter squadrons shot down more than 70 drones. The U.S. also moved an additional destroyer into the region to join a destroyer already there, and that helped shoot down four or six of those 100-plus ballistic missiles fired by Iran toward Israel. We know of no previous occasion in U.S.-Israeli history in which the U.S. launched jets during an attack on Israel or fired missiles from boats during an attack on Israel. Strategically, the reason that is so important, John, is that a senior administration official said that if this attack had succeeded, there would have been, quote, uncontrollable escalation and a broader regional conflict. The U.S. assesses that this attack was absolutely designed to kill Israelis and inflict widespread damage, and the fact is it didn't. And if that had happened, the assumption is that Israel and Iran perhaps might be at war already.
Looking forward, as Israel does ponder what to do next, What are the factors they're weighing, and what's the United States telling them?
Israeli media already reported that there was a quick cabinet meeting last night in which Israeli leaders considered an immediate strike, but that the Biden-Bibi phone call, the Netanyahu-Biden phone call, seems to have tamped down the possibility of that. And Israeli officials today are saying they will strike whenever they deem it proper to strike. There are many military options for Israel, of course, inside Iran itself, whether that's Iranian government, IRGC, the nuclear sites even. But a senior administration official said two important things today. One, Israel's made clear to us they are not looking for a significant escalation with Iran. If that is accurate, that means that they are not looking to strike directly against Iran, at least at the moment. And two, a senior administration official said very bluntly, we would not be part of any response they do. That is longstanding U.S. policy. But still, to say that is really to send the message to Israel, if you're going to do this, or especially if you're going to attack Iran, you would be on your own. And part of what the administration says it's trying to do is, quote, slow things down. And that, as you said at the top, is a focus on diplomacy. The U.S. hopes to isolate Iran through some of those sanctions and perhaps terrorism designations as well. And the flip of that is less isolation, they hope, on Israel. You've seen in the last few hours the European Union diplomats and the UN diplomats who have been very critical of Israel over the war in Gaza support Israel and then condemn Iran in no uncertain ways. And so that is where we are today with the U.S. focused on diplomacy. President Herzog of Israel saying, quote, we are not war seekers, but we'll see how Israel chooses to respond.
Nick Schifrin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Aaron David Miller. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's played a key role in U.S. Middle East policy for every president from Jimmy Carter to George W. Bush. Aaron, as Israel ponders its next move, how significant is it that this attack, as administration officials are saying, this attack was on the high side of what they were expecting, and yet Israel was really able to blunt it, that it caused relatively little damage?
Well, I think it's an extraordinary testament, frankly, to technology. Iron Dome and Arrow 3, which is the latest Arrow iteration, plus a significant amount of help from U.S. aircraft and Israeli aircraft. I mean, 350 crews, ballistic and pilotless drones. It's sort of a milestone, I would think, in modern warfare. Given the effectiveness of the Israeli layered defenses. So I think that's quite extraordinary.
And it's been reported that President Biden advised Prime Minister Netanyahu last night to take the win and do nothing. What do you think of that advice?
You know, I think that the president does not want to see an escalation, let alone something that could trip into a real regional war, which would be exchanges over a sustained period of time between Israel and Iran with ballistic missiles, a major flare-up turning into a major war between Israel and Hezbollah. And Hezbollah can cover most of Israel with its high-trajectory weapons. And I suspect Mr. Biden also understands that in a scenario like that, prospects of U.S. involvement are pretty high. So he's given the Israeli prime minister the best advice he can, pocket the win. You're now occupying the moral high ground. Tensions between the U.S. and Israel have essentially eased. Nobody's talking about conditioning military assistance or restricting it, let alone ending it to Israel. All of that, I think, is being taken seriously by the Israeli war cabinet.
You know, Iran said last night that this sort of closes the door on the Syrian attack strike that started this, that they were responding to. If Iran isn't going to do more, what about their proxies? What about the Houthis? What about Hezbollah? Are they likely to step up?
I think those attacks will continue, but I do believe, and Iran has a vote, but the Israelis have a vote as well, so it's well and good for the Iranians to say we're done, but they're not the only party involved in this. I suspect that pro-Iranian militias, at least for the short term, won't give the Israelis any pretext or excuse for responding, but I do think, and the war cabinet's divided on this, I think everyone, including the five, including Benny Gantz, believes the response is necessary. The timing of that response, I think, is up in the air, and the scale of that response is up in the air. So I think Israel will capitalize now on the fact that they've got an enormous—the G7 statement was extraordinary in terms of its support for Israel. No concern over Israeli strikes, and a strong statement that also appeared to isolate Iran. So I think the Israelis will ride that for a while, but at some point, I think there will be an accounting, and it probably will be directed at Iranian assets in Iran.
What does all this do to the war in Gaza, and especially the negotiations to try to get the hostages back?
I think it's a serious, serious tragedy on the part of the hostages and their families. Hamas had no real incentive. They believe that pressure on Israeli withdrawal of forces from Gaza was working in their favor. They were delaying, hoping to get a better deal. And frankly, I'm not sure the Netanyahu government felt all that much urgency, given the fact that any deal for free hostages is going to result in an asymmetrical number of Palestinian prisoners freed, which is going to stress Mr. Netanyahu's own coalition. But I think Hamas now will wait to see how much chaos and confrontation and confusion will result from this potential Iranian-Israeli fight. And I suspect there'll be no deal on hostages and probably no operation against Rafah either. But Gaza still will be the focus because of its proximity problem. And the Israelis have hostages, and they're still determined, I think, to eliminate the senior leadership.
Aaron David Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Talks aimed at the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza and a pause in fighting have stalled. Israel says Hamas rejected the latest proposal. Hamas is holding firm in its demand for a permanent ceasefire and for Israel's total withdrawal from Gaza. In Gaza, hundreds of Palestinian families moved north along the coast, despite warnings from the Israeli military that it's still an active war zone. More than a million Gaza residents had taken refuge in southern Gaza. And today, the Israeli military said it will call up two fresh reserve divisions for future operations in Gaza. Last night's attack has spurred House Republicans to try to quickly pass military aid for Israel. On Fox News, House Speaker Mike Johnson also left the door open to adding long-stalled money for Ukraine to the measure. The Senate approved aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan in February, but opposition from some ultra-conservative Republicans has blocked it in the House. In Sydney, police said the man who stabbed six people to death at a crowded shopping mall suffered from mental health issues and appears to have had no particular motive. Five of the six people killed by Joel Cauchy were women. He wounded dozens of others before police shot him dead. And artist and author Faith Ringgold has died. She created richly colored and detailed canvas panels that she called story quilts. They depicted the joys and burdens of Black life, especially the lives of Black women. As a social activist, she protested the lack of works by Black and female artists in the collection of American museums. Faith Ringgold was 93 years old. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the view from Ukraine, which says it needs more munitions and manpower in its war with Russia. And millions across southern Africa are facing hunger in the midst of extreme drought.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Ukraine has been at war with Russia for more than 2 years now, and there are signs that this year could be pivotal. Ukrainian officials say they need more munitions and support as Russia appears to be gaining ground. NewsHour co-anchor Amna Nawaz is on the ground in Kyiv tonight, beginning a week-long reporting trip. Amna, what's the state of the war now?
John, good evening from Kyiv. You know, the dire conditions that Ukrainian officials have been warning of for many months now do now seem to be here, with some even expressing concern that Ukraine is potentially at risk of losing this war this calendar year. Now, two forces are essentially colliding right now. At the same time, Ukraine is facing a critical shortage of ammunition and artillery. At the same time, they have a desperate need for additional air defenses. Russia has also been ramping up its air offensives. It is targeting Ukraine. Ukraine's energy systems with a precision and aggression we have not yet seen in the war, and Russia continues to make advances in the east. Now, we know those Russian forces already occupy much of that eastern Donbass region. They've made advances in the recent months. Back in February, they claimed the key city of Avdiivka. Some say they are now on the cusp of claiming another key city of Kharkiv. And, of course, they're also now relentlessly pummeling the city of Kharkiv in Ukraine's northeast. That is Ukraine's second largest city. It would be a major prize for the Russians and majorly demoralizing for Ukrainians. So, John, Ukraine is now facing challenges on these three fronts, an advancing Russian force, their own critical shortages, and, of course, exhausted troops after more than 2 years of fighting. John?
Anna, the shortages of munitions can be solved by getting more aid from other countries. But how? What's Ukraine doing about the exhausting troops, sort of filling that manpower gap?
And that manpower gap is real. It's been the source of much debate and many controversial proposals. President Zelensky has now lowered the draft age from 27 to 25, potentially meaning that thousands of more young men could be pulled into that fight. But, you know, John, right now in the capital city here, it sometimes feels like those front lines of the war can really be a world away. I mean, life here unfolds at a sort of normalish everyday pace. People go out for walks. They walk their dogs. They go to work, they sit outside at cafes and sip lattes, but that war looms large, and it does occasionally and regularly pierce through that sense of normalcy. There are, of course, burned out Russian military vehicles from early in the war on display in the city center here right behind me. There are memorials to the war dead lining the city walls. And of course, there are air sirens that do regularly go off, blaring across the city and forcing everyone to try to find shelter nearby. We experienced one yesterday ourselves. And John, I met one young Kyiv resident who could be entering that draft range soon. His name is Alexei. He works in real estate. His best friend is serving on the front line right now. But I asked him about the war and whether he feels pressure to join up.
I feel guilty. I feel guilty that I'm sleeping in the warm bed. I can take a shower. But from my side, I'm trying to help. Yeah, I know that it's not enough, and even when you died, it's not enough, but it is what it is. And
is any part of you scared that you might get drafted and have to go fight?
My mom, of course, is scared. My girlfriend is scared. So.
And you?
Of course I'm scared. Of course.
John, of course, with another Russian offensive expected this spring, young men like Alexei could be called to join the fight. So many questions remain here in Ukraine. And John, we'll be putting all of those questions directly to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky when I sit down with him for an exclusive interview tomorrow. We'll have more on that on the News Hour tomorrow night. John?
We look forward to that tomorrow night and all your reporting in the week ahead. Anna Navaz in Kyiv. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a growing hunger crisis across southern Africa, brought on by an extreme drought that's devastating farmers and the food supply. Ali Rogan has more.
A sweeping drought has devastated southern Africa, forcing Zimbabwe's president to declare a state of national disaster. It is the third country to do so in recent months, joining Malawi and Zambia. The El Nino-induced drought has scorched crops and left millions hungry in the region. Zimbabwe was once an agricultural powerhouse that exported grain to surrounding countries. But over the last two decades, it's been heavily dependent on aid agencies for food to survive.
Our food situation is difficult. We only eat once a day because we have nothing in the fields, not a single grain. Everything has dried up in the drought. We also have problems with sourcing water.
But as aid groups face budget cuts and broaden their operation to other conflicts, the crisis in southern Africa is expected to worsen. Tendai Marima is a freelance journalist based in Zimbabwe and joins me now. Tendai, thank you so much for being here. We just mentioned some of the top-line weather conditions that are contributing to low crop yield, but let's talk a little more in depth about the factors that are playing into these conditions being so bad in southern Africa right now.
The situation that is affecting southern Africa has to do with the late rainfalls that came. Normally in a season, the the rain would begin in about October or November and right up until April. But what we saw this year was that the rains were delayed and they only came very late in December. And it was just like patches of rain. And then after that, we had some very dry months. And this is when Zambia declared that there had been a national disaster because over 50% of the planted crops had failed. And for sure, a lot of harvests across different countries have been devastated.
Do experts agree that El Nino, the weather pattern that is global, is driving these cycles that we're seeing? And if so, why does it seem to be affecting Southern Africa so intensely at this moment?
I think with Southern Africa, from what climate scientists tell us, it's that it'll be 2 years of the El Nino phenomenon and then 1 year possibly of the La Nina phenomenon, which is a situation where there's too much rain. And this is what we've seen happening over the past few years. In 2019, we had cyclones that were affecting Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, and South Africa. And from that, a total of 1,000 people died because of those extreme floods. And now what we're seeing is that we've come again to a drought period. This is the El Nino part. And what they're anticipating is that there won't be much rain, and the lean season is likely to last well into 2024. So from about September 2025 is when people can possibly hope that there might be change, but it's uncertain at this stage.
An incredibly long amount of time. We mentioned that Zimbabwe and the surrounding countries were at one point regional breadbaskets, and now we're heavily dependent on aid to combat the suffering of civilians in situations like this. Can you just tell us about how stark that reversal of fortunes has been over the past couple decades?
It's been incredible to witness because I remember as a child growing up, I think one of the worst droughts that Zimbabwe experienced was in about 1992. I was still quite young then, but I do remember, you know, there being food handouts and things, but the country was able to recover. But when we got into the 2000s with all the other political things that happened in the country, and also because most of the commercial farms, the large commercial farms that used to produce a lot of food for domestic consumption and also for export, these were white-owned farms, and these were taken over during the land reform period, that it left the country without the farming resources and without the financial resources to be able to continue farming effectively. Whereas other countries in the region, they may have things to buffer, or at least plans in place to buffer themselves from the shocks of the drought. But for a country like Zimbabwe, it's in a dire state, and the situation is very severe because at least 2.7 million people are facing hunger.
In terms of some of the contemporary domestic issues that are playing out in Zimbabwe, in March, the government forcibly removed American aid workers from USAID. The president is also under U.S. sanctions right now for corruption and human rights abuses. How do those issues affect aid workers' ability to help civilians right now?
It casts a dark cloud over the level of support that USAID will be able to provide to the country. You know, security has heightened around food distributions. Another concern is possibly with the delivery of food aid, right? Because things such as cooking oil, because it's a fortified kind of cooking oil that USAID distributes to communities. Things such as that, also the cornmeal that USAID distributes, things have to be shipped. And it takes about 6 weeks for WFP and USAID to be able to get food into the country. So if there are all these sort of tensions, it raises questions, how much longer will it take, given the situation that there is suspicion from the state over the role that USAID is playing in the country? Although they have stated that their intentions are purely humanitarian and it is the largest donor to Zimbabwe, the government still has its suspicions. So, you know, it raises a lot of questions to say who will suffer if this suspicion then delays what is meant to be for the people.
Tendai Marima, freelance journalist based in Zimbabwe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. On Monday, the very latest on the situation in the Middle East, and Anna Navas sits down one-on-one with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Monday on the NewsHour. For now, I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.